John chapter 4, verses 1 through 6 this morning as we look at the intentional God. Now, when Jesus learned that the Pharisees had heard that Jesus was making and baptizing more disciples than John, although Jesus himself did not baptize, but only his disciples, he left Judea and departed again for Galilee. And he came to pass through Samaria. So he came to a town of Samaria called Sychar, near the field that is was Jacob had given to his son Joseph. Jacob's well was there. So Jesus, wearied as he was from his journey, was sitting beside the well. It was about the sixth hour. You look at the intentional God. Now, Jesus has just been with John the Baptist, setting the scene for you. And Jesus has begun baptizing now. And actually not Jesus himself, but his disciples are baptizing. But people are who were coming to John the Baptist are now coming to Jesus. And so there was an uproar among the disciples of John the Baptist about Jesus kind of taking over the ministry. As John the Baptist's ministry is dying out, Jesus' ministry is growing. But now there's a change of direction, physically and in missionally, a change of direction. Let's look at the catalyst for that change of direction in verse 1. Now, when Jesus had learned that the Pharisees had heard that Jesus was making and baptizing more disciples than John, although Jesus himself did not baptize, but only his disciples, he left Judea and departed again for Galilee. Here's the catalyst. Jesus is working in Judea. He's baptizing in Judea. John is further north, and so they're separated by a few miles, and Jesus is doing his thing. John's doing his thing. And then Jesus knows something. That translation here in verse 1 is actually kind of a bit of an unfortunate translation, because taken on its face, it would seem like Jesus has acquired some kind of new knowledge and something he maybe didn't already know. And I think there's sometimes that we don't pray because we forget that God is omniscient, that he knows all things, and Jesus is God. He's fully God. And if Jesus is fully God, then he's also omniscient. He should already know all things, and this is, in fact, the case. We don't see anyone bringing this information to Jesus. We don't see any of his disciples telling him what the Pharisees had found out. He already knew. And as we'll see further along in this chapter, Jesus demonstrates his omniscience to the woman at the well. But the word here for know is gnosko. It's to know. It's to learn, to understand. So when it says Jesus learned something, just understand that he already had that knowledge. He already knew it. Jesus knows where you're at this morning. Jesus knows where your heart is at this morning. Jesus knows where your mind is at this morning. Jesus knows where your body is at this morning. Even if the pastor has no clue, Jesus knows where you are this morning. Isn't it good to know that nothing we do escapes the purview of God? That's good to know. It's comforting that we can never go anywhere that God doesn't see us and love us and care for us and know what's going on both outside and around us and inside our hearts. But it's also can be troubling as we understand that everything we do is done in God's magnifying glass, that he can see everything that we do. Even the secret sins that we think no one knows, even the thoughts of our minds that we would never tell our spouse, never tell our kids, never tell our neighbors, never tell our coworkers, even the thoughts of our mind, Jesus sees those things everywhere. He is omniscient. So Jesus knows. And what does he know? Well, he knows that the Pharisees had heard something. Pharisees had heard Jesus' disciples were now baptizing more people than John the Baptist. So what are the Pharisees going to do? They're no longer going to focus on John the Baptist because Jesus is now the greater threat. People are escaping their hold, their clutches, their religious authority, and they're going out of the city and they're coming to Jesus to be baptized. One of the reasons that Jesus leaves the area, one of the reasons that he heads toward Galilee, is to avoid an unnecessary confrontation with the Jewish authorities, with the Sanhedrin, with the Pharisees. Now, this isn't because Jesus was scared. I want you to understand that. Because if you look through the Gospels, Jesus has no problem addressing the Pharisees. He has no problem confronting them. He has no problem calling it like it is when it comes to the Pharisees. And he certainly doesn't pull any punches. I mean, Jesus at one point calls the Pharisees dead men's bones, whitewashed tombs. You look really good on the outside, but on the inside, You've got dead men's bones and you're dying. You're stinking of death. So Jesus has no problem confronting people with the truth. But at this time, it's unnecessary for him to confront the Jewish authorities. So he's moving on. And what did the Pharisees hear? They heard that his disciples were baptizing more people. This also could create a potential second conflict. The second reason to move along is to avoid any conflict with the disciples of John the Baptist. Now, we just looked at John the Baptist's exaltation of Jesus Christ in John chapter 3. We just looked at John the Baptist saying, I must decrease, but he must increase. We just looked at John the Baptist saying that the one who has come from heaven is above all. We just talked about the superiority of Jesus Christ in all things. John just talked about that, and we talked about it last week as we saw the end of John chapter 3. John the Baptist has no problem with Jesus taking over the ministry. John the Baptist is absolutely okay with it. He has no issues with it. But that doesn't mean that all of his disciples feel the same way. Now, I want you to note here that Jesus is not baptizing people. Who is baptizing people on Jesus' behalf? His disciples. So John the Baptist's disciples see not Jesus taking over the ministry of John. They see Jesus' disciples taking over the ministry of their rabbi, their teacher. Now, I don't know about you, but there's got to be some feelings of animosity there, some feelings of jealousy, some feelings of inadequacy, perhaps some feelings of uselessness as they all the things that they've done. They followed John the Baptist this entire time. People have been coming to John in droves. People have been baptizing. John's ministry has become known all throughout the region. And they've become popular and famous. And people have come to them. And they've been looked at upon as because they were John's disciples from the beginning, they've been looked at upon as somewhat important and useful people. And now everyone's going to Jesus. And I know the spiritual answer is to say, you know, whatever advances the kingdom of God, that's fine, you know. Whatever moves the kingdom of God along. But think about it this way. If you showed up in church this morning and you were the only one there because everyone else joined another church over the weekend, how would you feel? Probably not great. Because you're feeling like God has been using you. You're feeling like God is doing something and now everyone is gone to be used by God somewhere else. And by the way, that is the one way that I feel good about people leaving the church is when they go to serve somewhere else. I never feel comfortable with people leaving the church because they have disagreements. I never feel comfortable with people leaving the church because they just don't like us. I never feel comfortable with people leaving the church because we're not perfect. I never feel comfortable with people leaving the church because they just want to do their own thing. What I have comfort in, what I have joy in, is when God raises up people through our church and He takes them out and sends them out to serve somewhere else. If you're going to leave to serve, man, leave with my blessing. I love to see the kingdom advance. It doesn't matter how the kingdom is advanced. But if you just leave because you're angry, that's probably not a biblical reason to leave. Probably not a biblical reason to leave a church. So here's Jesus and his disciples baptizing these people. His disciples are baptizing. John's disciples are probably feeling like they have become obsolete. And that's a hard feeling. And so Jesus is now leaving the area because because he doesn't want to have a conflict with the disciples of John the Baptist. Again, John's okay. Maybe his disciples are not all okay. Here's the thing. Here's the principle about this. Completing God's mission is more important than creating conflict. It's more important than addressing conflict. It's more important to do the work that God has called you to do than it is to determine who's right and who's wrong over secondary issues. Now, there's some things that we fight about. There's some things that we will stand on. Some things that we will not back down from, the essential doctrines of the Christian faith. We will not move from those things. We will not back down from those things. But some things are just not worth fighting over. Especially when they create conflict that deters you from completing the mission that God's given you. Something else to understand here is that God's timing is always perfect. God's timing in all things is perfect. God's timing in all things is right. Even when we think God should move at a different time or in a different way, God never asks for our advice, regardless of how freely we offer it. The problem isn't that we don't want and know what God ought to be doing. The problem is that He doesn't need your help or mine. That our advice doesn't mean a whole lot to God. That doesn't mean that our opinions are insignificant. It just means that compared to Christ, our opinions are insignificant. So that's the catalyst. That's the reason that they're moving. So what's the destination? Look in verse 3. He left Judea and departed again for Galilee. Galilee is the destination. Galilee, due north from where he'd been working in Judea. If you had a map of Israel in the year zero, it'd be this map, and you'd see that Judea was in the south, the southern kingdom, and that Galilee was way up here to the north, and Jesus is down here working, and he wants to go all the way up there. Several days a journey for him to go. Now remember that Jesus had just come from Galilee. His first miracle. You remember his first miracle? Turning the water into wine. Where? At Cana of Galilee. So Jesus has already been working in Galilee, and now he's coming back to Galilee. And there's several routes he could take. Look at the routes here, the route in verse 4. He left Judea and departed again for Galilee, and he had to pass through Samaria. Now John makes it sound like Jesus had no option but to pass through Samaria. That's not true. That's not what John is saying here. John is not saying that Jesus had no alternatives. There's several routes he could have taken. Again, your imaginary map here. Jesus could have gone out by the Mediterranean and taken the sea route. The most common route for people to take from that area, from Jerusalem or from Judea all the way up to Galilee, was to go down to the Jordan River and to walk across the Jordan and to walk along the Jordan where it's a nice flat plain by the river, and then walk up and then cross the river again and go into Galilee. That was the most common path to take, the most common route. There are lots of trade routes that went around Samaria without going through Samaria. And the reason why is because the route through Samaria was usually avoided because, number one, it was very mountainous. I mean, if we're going to go for a walk, I would rather walk on the plain or walk through a field than walk up and down a mountain. I don't know about you. I'd much rather do that. But the other reason that the route through Samaria was avoided is not only because it was mountainous, but because there was tension between the Jews and the Samaritans. Racial tension, as a matter of fact. We'll look at that a little bit more in depth next week. But John tells us in verse 4 that Jesus had to pass through Samaria. Why did Jesus have to pass through Samaria? Because he had business in Samaria. There was a spiritual appointment for Christ in Samaria. That isn't the way we would have chosen to go. That isn't the way that most of the Jews chose to go. It probably wasn't the way that Jesus' disciples want to go. When Jesus told his disciples, and I don't even know if he told his disciples which way he was going. He probably just led. Jesus did a lot of that. Just, here we go, let's go, follow me, let's go. He didn't do a lot. You don't see a lot of Jesus meeting with his disciples saying, all right, guys, let's come up with a plan. Let's create a committee. But before we create the committee, let's create a committee on committees so that we can form the committee to come up with a plan to figure out the best route. Now, we need to look at it in terms of budgetary reasons. And we need to look at it in terms of, okay, what is the most practical? And are there other things we can do in this area? Are there things that we can see and do? And let's get together and come to a consensus. Let's talk about this and work. Now, Jesus said, here we go, let's go. That's how Jesus was. Let's just go. And the thing is that we don't get to have a negotiation with God on where He's going to go, where He's going to work, what He's going to do. We don't have that privilege. We have one job. Follow. That's it. Let Jesus lead and you follow. It seems to be kind of easy, but we want to get our two cents in. Again, God doesn't need your opinion. God doesn't need your directions. He knows where He's going to go. He knows where He's headed to. And again, this isn't the way that God that I would have chosen to go. But God tends to work. Listen, God tends to work in ways that we don't expect, in places that we don't expect, through people that we don't expect. That's how God works. God works in ways that we don't expect, in places that we don't expect, through people that we wouldn't expect. And He works in us when we do the difficult things, the hard things. Hard things. If you want to be used greatly by God, start doing the hard things. Start doing the hard things. What do I mean by that? Start approaching people that most wouldn't approach. Start traveling difficult roads. Start stepping out of your comfort zone to obey God in areas that you've never obeyed Him before. Do the hard things. Look, it's easy. It's easy to just come to church and check off our box and say we've done all that is required for us to do, do the bare minimum of our Christian service to God. But God will use the man or woman who has decided that they will do the hard things. You know what's a hard thing? Waking up in the morning to have Bible study. You know, it's a hard thing telling your coworker about the gospel of Jesus Christ. You know, it's a hard thing putting aside a meal or two. I know. Putting aside a meal or two to pray. You know, it's a hard thing saying, I'm going to go to India. Never been there. Don't know how I'm going to afford it. Don't know what it's going to be like. I'm going to encounter things that I would never experience otherwise. I'm going to be so out of my comfort zone. And it doesn't matter. I've been to India, and when I go back, I will still be out of my comfort zone. We could go there every week for a year, and I'd still be out of my comfort zone when I go there. Do the hard things. The problem with the churches in America, and our church is included in this, the problem with the churches in America is that we've stopped doing the hard things. We've stopped doing the hard things. And here's what's interesting about that. We stop doing the hard things, and then it becomes difficult to do the easy things. Church attendance, that should be easy. Giving to the kingdom work, that should be easy. Reading our Bibles, that should be easy. Praying, that should be easy. Those aren't difficult things. Those aren't graduate-level Christian activities. Those are basic, I've been saved for 30 minutes, I can do these things. But when you stop doing the hard things, the easy things then become difficult. It's when you do the hard things for God, when you go to the difficult places, when you reach the unapproachable people, when you travel the more difficult road, when you go those routes, the easy things become second nature. We're going to talk more about Samaria next week. For now, just know that if you're a Jew in the first century, you only travel there if you had to. Kind of how I feel about going to Walmart. I'm not a fan of Walmart, man. There's just, why should I have to walk for 30 minutes to get a loaf of bread? And if it's snow in the forecast, you won't even get that. It's not going to happen. So do the hard thing. So that's the route. That's the catalyst. That's the motivation. That's the change in direction. Let's move quickly to verse 5. Verse 5. So he came to a town of Samaria called Sychar, near the field that Jacob had given to his son Joseph. Here's the town. Came to a town of Samaria. What does that mean? Well, it means it was full of Samaritans. They all had purses. Samaritans' purses. So, Jesus has taken his disciples through this region. He leads them right into a Samaritan town. So it's bad enough that Jesus, I'm sure his disciples are thinking, it's bad enough, Jesus, that you wanted to go through Samaria. You chose the difficult route. You chose the route that's uncomfortable for us. You chose the route that we would not have traveled. It's bad enough that you want to go through this region. Now you've led us right into a city. Right into a city full of these people. Jesus, we don't like these people. Don't you understand? We don't like these people. We don't like religious zealots. so Jesus saves religious zealots. We don't like tax collectors, so Jesus calls Matthew a tax collector. We don't like lepers, so Jesus goes up and heals lepers. We don't like the things that we don't like, God almost takes delight in using despite us. He leads them into a town of Samaria. The town's name is Sychar, which means drunken. That's a great name for a town, isn't it? Where do you live? I live Drunkenville. That's where I live. Gee, I wonder what they do there. So there's that. You know, it's the town. Town's name is Drunken. This town is actually mentioned several times in the Old Testament. Although in the Old Testament it's known as Shechem. If you do a word search on the word Shechem, it's the name of someone who is a very bad guy in the Old Testament. It's also the name of a town and a region. Here's some things to know about Sychar or Shechem. Number one is promised to Abraham by God. Number two is purchased by Jacob, Genesis 33:19. We see Jacob purchasing a field, an area there. Jacob then, in the next verse, 33:20 in Genesis, sets up an altar there to God. Jacob then gives it to Joseph as an inheritance. Joseph's bones are buried there, Joshua 24:42. Joshua summons the leaders of Israel there to pray and to seek God, probably at the altar that Jacob has built in Joshua 24:1. It was a city of refuge for manslayers, Joshua 21:21. What does that mean? Well, there was in the Old Testament, they set up, under the Mosaic Law, a number of cities that were cities of refuge for manslayers. So if you unintentionally killed someone, before whoever could get even with you, you could go to that city of refuge. You could go to the city of refuge, and no one could touch you there until you came before the judge, until your trial was taken care of. It's a city of refuge for you to go to. So Shechem, or Sychar, is one of those cities. Something else we know about the city, it's near Joseph's field. Genesis 48:22, again, the land there has been given by Jacob to Joseph as an inheritance. And so now you know a little bit more about Sychar than you probably ever knew before. So now that we're done with the geography lesson, what's the point? What's the story behind this town? Why this town? Why did Jesus go to this place? Here's what you need to know about Shechem or Sychar. It was given by God. It was in Canaan. It's in the promised land. Jacob set up an altar to worship the one true God there. But over time, people have fallen into idolatry. They've fallen into idolatry. But here's the good news. Jesus, who restores all things, who heals all things, Jesus is going to restore once again. The one who keeps the promises of God has come here intentionally to restore the worship of the one true God. Spoiler alert, by the time this story is over, story of the woman of the well, you'll again see people worshiping the one true God in the place where Jacob set up an altar to him. Here's good news for you, Christian. Here's good news for you. That if you are not walking with the Lord, if you're walking in a guilty distance from God, God does not abandon His people. God does not abandon His people when they are hurting. God does not abandon His people when they are struggling. God does not abandon His people when they are failing. God does not abandon anyone or anything. God will do what He has purposed to do, even if He has to go what we would say is out of His way to restore it. Jesus has come to this town specifically, intentionally, to restore the worship of the one true God. Because the story of the woman at the well, as we get into it more and more next week and in the following weeks, the story of the woman at the well is not about the woman at the well. It's not about the village. You know what it's about? It's about Christ. It's about the worship of the one true God. And that's what Jesus has come here to do. Restore the worship of the one true God. Finally, in verse 6. Let's look at the well. Verse 6, Jacob's well was there. So Jesus, wearied as he was from his journey, was sitting beside the well. It was about the sixth hour. It's about the sixth hour. Jesus is weary. Jesus is weary. Now we know, hypostatic union, two natures, fully God, fully man. We know that Jesus was fully God, but we also know that he was fully man. He experienced hunger. He experienced thirst. He experienced happiness. He experienced sadness. He experienced grief. He experienced joy. He experienced pain. He experienced weariness. Here's something cool for you to know. The next time that you're just slap worn out, anybody ever been slap worn out? They don't say that up north. You know, they don't say slap anything up north. Unless they're actually slapping somebody. They don't say that. The next time you just slap worn out, man, pray about that. You know why? Because Jesus understands what it feels like to be worn out. He understands. He understands what it feels like to be weary. He understands what it feels like to be physically beaten down. He's weary. He's been walking a long way. They're traveling through the mountains. And I get worn out walking in the parking lot. They're traveling through the mountains. No air conditioning. No car. He comes to Jacob's well, not the Christian bookstore. And he sits down. He sits down. Why? Because he's weary. But he's also waiting. He's also waiting. He's sitting beside the well. He's thirsty. But he does not get his own drink. It's a deep well. It's good water. Good, deep water. But he has nothing to draw the water out with, as we'll see later on in this passage. Now, Jesus is God. So if he wanted to just get some water, he could have just gotten some water. He could have made water. He turned the water into wine. He could turn the dirt into water. He has power over everything that he has created. So he could certainly find a way to come up with some water. But he waits. Why does Jesus wait? Because he knows what's about to take place. I want you to think for a second as we remember back to the beginning of today's message. The intentionality of Christ. Why did Jesus avoid the conflicts with the Pharisees? Why did he avoid the conflicts with the disciples of John the Baptist? Because if he had gotten to Shechem, if he had gotten to Sychar at 12:30, he would have missed the woman at the well. But here he is, right on time. He has a spiritual appointment, and he waits. Instead of meeting his own needs, Christ allows himself to be served by someone else so that the kingdom can be advanced. This is something you can take with you today. Instead of meeting your own needs, allow yourself to be served by someone else so that the kingdom of God can be advanced. So that the kingdom of God can be advanced. You know what the church is for? One of the reasons the church exists is so that we can serve each other. So we can minister to one another. So that we can bear each other's burdens. So that we can take care of each other's needs and concerns. I'm so glad that God's given us godly deacons that care for our church, that meet the needs of our church. But we all should be meeting one another's needs. And Christ could have served himself. He could have served himself. He could have got water. Him and his disciples could have just gone about their merry way and continued on, but Jesus waits to allow himself to be served so that the kingdom can be advanced. We'll see that next week. And it was about the sixth hour. The last thing that John tells us here in verse 6 is it was about the sixth hour. It's about noon. It's about noon. Or if you didn't set your clocks forward, about 11 a.m. It'd be interesting if we're still here in 15 minutes. It'd be interesting to see if anyone comes in. The first time I visited the church I used to attend, Hollywood, the first time I visited in a long time. I'd gone there as a college student back in the 80s. That dates me. First time our family had gone to visit there, we had arrived and were surprised to hear that the pastor had only preached for 10 minutes. We came in, the place was packed. We're like, wow, this has really got some stuff going on. We had to sit on the back pew. We sat down. People kind of looked at us sideways. Okay, fine. And we sat down. The message had already begun, so somehow we missed the music. And the preacher preached for about 10 minutes and wrapped up. I thought, man, this is my kind of church. Preaching for 10 minutes, that's awesome. Some of y'all are probably wishing that they had found a church just like that. Here's the problem. We forgot to set our clocks forward. So we weren't an hour, we weren't on time, we weren't an hour early, we were an hour late. They've been preaching for about an hour. So we just caught the last 10 minutes of it. It was around noon when Jesus is here. And the encounter is about to begin. Here's what you need to know about Jesus. He's always in the right place. He's always in the right place at the right time. He's always in the right place at the right time and the right mindset. He's always in the right place at the right time, the right mindset, prepared to speak the truth into someone's life. So you know what? I'm just not hearing from God. I'm just not hearing from God. Well, it's not because God doesn't want to speak to you. What is hindering you from hearing from God? Because God's ready to speak to you. James tells us that if anyone lacks wisdom, he should seek God. And God will, who gives all things liberally, gives all things graciously, will grant us wisdom. God's always ready to speak to us. Maybe you showed up this morning, you weren't prepared to hear God speak. Listen to this message later in the right mindset to hear from God, because Jesus is always at the right place. Jesus is always at the right time. He's always in the right mindset, and He's always prepared to speak truth to us through His Word. That's how He communicates to us through His Word. So the same way, you and I need to always be in the right place. Where's the right place? Wherever Jesus is, that's the right place. We always need to be on the right time, on God's agenda, God's schedule, in the right mindset, prepared to be used by God to minister to others. Always rightly prepared to, as God does, speak truth into the life of other people. Jesus is ready. The encounter is about to begin. Many people's lives are going to be changed for eternity. Why? All because Jesus did not take the shortcut. All because Jesus did not allow racial or ethnic tension to hinder Him from His work. All because Jesus was willing to seek out and engage the lost. Why did the Son of Man come? Luke 19:10. To seek and save that which was lost. All because Jesus was willing to put aside His thirst for a while for the sake of the mission. Why? All because Jesus was intentional. Intentional. Church, we need to be intentional. Look, people are not going to wander into the kingdom by accident. If the God of the universe had to be intentional to reach the lost, do you think we need to be intentional? We need to be intentional. We need to be looking for opportunities. We need to be doing the hard things. We need to be not taking shortcuts in our Christian walk. Lord, the time for cruise control for the church is over. It's time to move. It's time to act. It's time to accelerate. It's time to get involved in the mission. Because the days are short. And Christ is returning. He's appointed that time. It's coming. When He will judge the world in righteousness. So He commands men everywhere to repent and believe the gospel. Will we be intentional as a church? Will we be intentional as believers in Jesus Christ?